30s. I am 30. 29th of April 1983 to the 28th of April 1984. Above. I was still managing Bananarama by Paul Austin. Conventional milestones had never, ever interested me. I'd always preferred to observe points of change as they happened in my own life and in the wider society, irrespective of my age or a date. That approach shifted round about the time I turned 30, leading up to my 30th birthday. The inner demon had started thrusting questions into my mind for which I had no easy answers. Aren't you just wasting your life? Is this it then, Bill? Couldn't you do something a bit more honest? I had not expected hitting 30 to be such a big deal. Outwardly, it was all fun, creativity and success. At the time, I was still managing Bananarama, working towards the issue of Cruel Summer in June. I'd persuaded them to work on a darker and more paranoid lyrics about being isolated from a loved one in an oppressively hot city. Pavements burning, the air being heavy and dry, and strange voices saying things they can't understand. It showed a different, more mature side of Sarah, Siobhan and Karen, and was a hit. But the inner demon kept on pestering me, like some drunk in a pub that thinks he might have seen you in a movie or on a wanted poster. Did I just need a change? A bigger house, a new girlfriend, more interesting friends? For much of the previous year, I simply did not know what I wanted or what I needed. I was on autopilot, faking contentment and wondering how I ended up managing a chart-topping girl band, producing music that did not excite me or threaten the status quo or push any artistic boundaries. I felt that I was letting myself down, not being at all true to my ideals. I started shoving back on the inner demon. If you are so smart, why don't you come up with something? Help me. Don't hector me. Shut the fuck up. But he did not shut up. The bastard would not let up. His suggestions, including that I become a monk or a rag and bone man or a drag queen like Divine. The last was the best of his ideas. As a teenage boy, I had developed hives when I tried on my mother's lipstick one day when I was alone at home after school. Whilst all this inner turmoil was playing out, Thatcher got re-elected by a landslide in June, setting herself up for a full-scale assault on Arthur Scargill the next year. A depressing, divisive time in the UK, which did not help my mindset. Soon after Thatcher's victory in June, I decided to properly embrace the inner demon. Stop resisting him. Agree with him. I paid for a full-page advert in Smash Hits to publish a letter resigning as the manager of Bananarama. The inner demon could not have been happier. It included a lengthy diatribe against the music business, coupled with some other diversionary nonsense. Now, as I approach 70 and have reread this missive, I am hugely embarrassed. The letter was a complete smokescreen for me allowing myself to be so easily assimilated and controlled by an industry that I had subverted for many years. It is a tedious document, so I won't print it here. But if you Google, "Has Bill Drummond gone nuts?" you will very quickly get sight of the original. Jettisoning the day job gave me more time to chat properly with the inner demon. And chat we did. Sometimes I would come to my senses in the Robin Hood in Sheringham, a favourite pub of mine at the time, and realise that I'd been having a lengthy conversation out loud with the inner demon while standing at the bar. The other regulars would quietly look away as they realised the conversation had ended and I had returned to reality. It was a good, interesting time, overflowing with debate, arguments and ideas, many questions but still no answers. The inner demon had encouraged action, but had given no direction. I was lost. After around 2 months of regular episodes of drunken joshing with the inner demon in the Robin Hood, I was approached by a bohemian-looking man of about the same age as me. I will call him Vaughn, because he does not want his real name to be published. 40 years later, we're both still good friends. But the first thing he ever said to me was, "Are you okay, mate? Do you need a help?" I'm not normally one to admit to needing help. But he was, well, still is, a thoughtful, kind man. So I explained at length that I was in a desperate search for a new road. We had a long conversation, but in the end, Vaughan's simple suggestion turned out to be the saving of me. He lived in Holtsfield, a thriving but hidden community near Merton on the Gower Peninsula that had started out as a holiday accommodation and later became a refuge for people whose houses were bombed during the Second World War. They had since become permanent homes and a diverse, independent, tight-knit tribe had been born. He suggested that I renovate a derelict wooden chalet not far from his own and get my head together in the country for a while, like a 60s rock star moving out of London. Give myself space, get involved with real people, complete something real. I fancied rediscovering my carpentry skills and reconnecting with my artistic creativity. On a whim, I drove back to Merton the very next day with Vaughan in his white 1971 Vauxhall Viva. And after many hours as a passenger, found myself walking down an unremarkable country lane stretching down towards a seeming wilderness towards Holtsfield, where I was welcomed by an eclectic group of outsiders, young and old, living remarkable lives in a ramshackle isolation. By the 29th of April 1984, the renovation was complete, and I realised that I had stopped talking to the inner demon. Perhaps he had stopped talking to me. I was going to climb back through the ropes, into the ring, and onto my next fight, living my life wholly on my terms. It had been a tumultuous year.
Below. My Story is His Story by Andrew Brooks. 29th April 1983. I'm looking through the southeast-facing window of a council flat on the 17th floor of a tower block in Salford, England. Rising above the urban sprawl of Greater Manchester are the peaks and plateaus of Derbyshire and Yorkshire, resembling a bag of bones, kicked and rearranged until the skeleton resembles something less like the anthropomorphized ideal of the ancients, and more like a cow dumped on a road, stopping traffic. Roadkill. Following the line of hills until it collapses into Cheshire, I see the Lovell telescope at Jodrell Bank, receiving signals from out there, in space. I wonder for a moment if I have outgrown the garden of earthly delights. The reason I'm here, in this council flat in Salford, England, isn't important. It's a temporary measure. This council flat belongs to an acquaintance of mine, a vegetarian. There are rules in place for my temporary stay here, but I've already broken most of them. The consumption of animal flesh on the premises is top of the list of things not to do. So, with that rule broken on an almost daily basis, I must move on from here to save my bacon, my pound of flesh. I'm now 30 years old, and I'm hungry. It's a different kind of hunger to the one that propelled me through youth. The adrenaline has been replaced with something heavier. They say that tastes change, and I suppose they're right, but I can tell you that my palate needs more than cleansing at this point in time. They, as in they that say tastes change, also say money can't buy taste. Perhaps true, but I'm not interested in the kind of nouvelle cuisine that causes arguments over portion sizes. Nouvelle as in new. A whole new you. I watch the traffic from the kitchen window. In the distance, the M62 carries vehicles high over the Pennines. Radio masts stand like upright hypodermic syringes. Directly in front of me, the A6 is spitting vehicles onto the roundabout and into the arteries and veins of northern England. It's a hypnotic scene that I struggle to look away from. But I have my own journey to take, and I must prepare. Take the tourniquet off. Take me to the airport. I pick up a tray in the buffet restaurant, having cleared customs with minimal baggage and fuss. Travelling light. A border crossing with all the civility we have come to expect in the 20th century. Us global citizens denying ourselves those unfashionable tribal tendencies. I slide my tray along the steel bars and under the heat lamps, past the plates of food slowly losing the will to live and destined for pig feed, until I arrive at the tea caddy. A cup of tea is all I need for now. I'll take a risk with airplane food later, but I've no appetite at the moment. The long haul. 1st May 1983. I arrive in Lima, Peru, refreshed and focused, having eaten the protein and carbohydrate presented to me in a foil tray 35,000 feet up in the air somewhere over the Atlantic. I pull out a scrap of paper with a location on it and set about finding a taxi driver willing to take me there for a fair price. After reactions ranging from bemusement to belly laughs, when the line of drivers next to their beaten-up vehicles see the destination I have in mind, an elderly man with a kind smile takes my hand and leads me to his car. His grip is firm but tender. Safe. He starts the engine, and we travel in silence. We travel for hours, climbing higher as the roads give way to crumbling tracks and the cliff faces become increasingly sheer. As the sun heads towards the horizon, the landscape takes on a sinister beauty. Illuminated by the car headlights, the dark jungle doesn't reveal its inhabitants, although I sense there are countless eyes watching us. The garden of earthly delights. I've been looking straight ahead for the whole journey, but feeling unsettled by things I cannot see, I now turn my gaze to the driver. In the fading light, I trace the lines of his face. He looks younger than when we met outside the airport. Handsome. The dim red light of the fuel gauge reflects in his eyes. He looks ahead. Dawn breaks, and I sense the driver has taken me almost as far as he can. He brings the car to a halt, turns off the engine, and looks ahead. In front of us is dense forest, but the driver appears to be looking deeper. He looks even younger in this light, beautiful even. I feel a familiar sensation, but it seems somehow out of place. My veins pulse, and I close my eyes. I can hear a river. I know what this is. The driver places his hand, firm and tender, on my thigh. I have an erection. My pound of flesh. Keep the river on your right. As if to break a spell, he spoke these words, and I knew he had taken me as far as he could. These words are the only words spoken between the driver and I. He looks ahead. I walk into the dense forest. I can hear a river. 28th April 1984. I walk into Lima Airport. My body is stripped of clothing and shoes, painted ochre. Almost a year ago, I joined the Arakmbut tribe in the Peruvian Amazonia. They accepted me and I danced round the fire with them. I communicated with them through art. I hunted with them. I joined them in the ritual consumption of human flesh. I lay with them at night, our bodies free of inhibition and entwined, the pleasures of the flesh. 28 years ago, another man took the same journey into the Peruvian Amazonia and joined the Arakmbut. My story is his story. Tomorrow I will be 31 years old, and my story changes hands.
A Troubled Dream. Choppy Waters by Harvey Johnman. It's always on a ship. A boat, but most likely a ferry. But never the one across the Mersey. This one is in sunnier climes. Crossing the Ionian Sea from Corfu to Albania, perhaps. I am seated downstairs. Maybe it's the poop deck. And it's very busy. British tourists mainly. But a decent amount of locals. Maybe smugglers, as they all seem to have large homemade packages strung about their person. The room is quite dark, but there is light coming in from a large picture window, not portholes. I can see land in close proximity. Albania. It is barren and dried out. The sun is beating down on it. However, despite the beautiful weather and the apparent lack of wind, the boat is worryingly lurching from side to side, massively, in 45 degree shifts. Most people are seated on large orange plastic benches and holding on for dear life. Others, not so lucky, are being tossed around the floor. Tables and chairs unfixed are sliding back and forth while sweaty crew members try to hold them firm. The crew look really concerned, which is doing very little to calm the passengers. I don't like the look of this, and see this as only going one way. That way is with me and everyone else in the water. I scan the room for life jackets or anything that could help me float. Nothing. I am with Big in Japan, but this is now, and none of us are teenagers anymore. I don't know why we're all here, and I don't question it. It's accepted, and anyway there are bigger issues to concern myself with. Holly Johnson still looks young despite his age. He still has a peroxide buzz cut and panda bear makeup. He is standing in the middle of the melee and miraculously stood firm in the middle of the room, unaffected by the almighty swinging. He is shouting at the crew, I cannot tell if it's advice or abuse he's given them. Jane Casey and Budgie are sitting beside each other on a bench opposite me. Both dressed in black, both golden-haired, drinking from a shared pint glass full of a dark brew, and both evidently drunk. Every time the boat moves, screams rain out from the passengers, and Jane echoes their scream with a sarcastic shriek of her own. Budgie laughs wildly and takes another swig. Ian Brodie is lying in a corner, back against the wall, and looking somewhat distressed. He is also holding a pint glass, but he's using that to be sick into. It's half full, and I grin, thinking to myself that he's always been a pint half full guy. I try to get up to go over and help Ian, but I'm thrown back onto my seat. Maybe best to wait. But I wonder how long this will last, and whether I'll get a chance. No one knows what to do. It's mayhem. Dave Balf is somewhere behind me. I can't see him, but I can hear him. I can tell he's holding court to anyone who will listen and offering wisdom. This is nothing. This is like a duck pond compared to the North Sea. He keeps on repeating the same sentence with mild glee. I doubt very much whether he's ever been in the North Sea. I start to feel sick myself and decide that being outside on the top deck would be the best way forward. I slip out of my seat and I'm immediately thrown forward onto all fours. The floor is covered in puddles. Of what? I don't know. I try get up onto my feet, but I'm thrown flat. I determine that crawling is the best way forward and set off across the floor in the direction of the stairs. En route, people are banging into me, falling over my back and cursing me. When I reach the bottom of the stairs, I am soaking wet and covered in bruises. I look up the stairs and I'm blinded by the sun coming in through the hatch. There's a double handrail, but even with that, the heavy lurching of the ship still makes progress difficult, and once or twice I'm thrown against the sides. But I retain my grip and get through the opening and onto the open deck. As soon as I get on the deck, I'm thrown backwards to the rear of the ship. Up on top, the ferry is violently lurching forward into the sea and then rising back. There's salty spray everywhere, and I can only just make out the passengers all around the outside of the deck. Each and every one is strapped to the railings in some manner. Rope, belts, clothes, each other, all looking anguished and holding on for dear life as the boat rises up into the air and then crashes back down, each time just above the water level. I land between a couple and grab a space in the ranks, lashing my arms around the wooden rails. As below, crew are fighting in vain to hold on the furniture, which in this case is cheap white plastic garden tables and chairs. It's a lost cause. And after more ups and downs, it's all flying above our heads, over the side, and into the briny. All of a sudden, there is a large spurt of water thrust out of the hatch that I just emerged from. In that spout, all manner of debris is cast out. It forms a large blue pool in the middle of the deck. As it settles, I can see bodies floating in it. And now the ferry is dipping beneath the water, forward and aft. Each time getting further down, and the pool grows, as does the number of bodies in it. It never ends well. Sometimes we are all in a drink. Sometimes awake just before we do.